This is the audio that goes with McClon versus Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission. This is the beginning of the mortgages segment of the course. And we're really going to be kind of doing two kind of major things here. One is just kind of introducing everyone to the concept of a mortgage and what a mortgage is, who's the mortgagor, mortgagee. We talked about this a little bit with Harnes versus Sprague. And then we're going to talk about some specifics about mortgage law, really focusing on what happened during the kind of 08, 07 time period where we had a huge crash. It's kind of almost crazy to talk about this right now, a huge crash in the housing market, which had a lot of kind of follow-on effects. And in some ways this is timely because a lot of people are talking about whether what's happening right now, how does it relate to or not relate to what happened in 08. So the first slide just starts to introduce some of the basics of mortgages. The one thing about a mortgage, and this is kind of similar with what we've seen with other concepts in property law where there is a mixture of property law and contract law. That is, you have some kind of an instrument, so a lease, let's say, or a conveyance, right? Here it's the promissory note that basically says, I, as the mortgagor, am willing to put up some collateral in exchange for some type of a transfer of cash, and there'll be some time period in which I will pay it back under some interest rate, etc. But it creates a property interest, which is what makes it unique beyond contract law, and that is it creates this concept of a mortgage. And the reason we have this unique is because we're dealing with real property, and at the time these were mainly done with people's houses, and we get these kind of concerns when we're dealing with a residence, a place where someone lives. And what happens, particularly if the promissory note requirements are not being met, that is, the mortgagor fails to pay the mortgage. And so the terminology, sometimes to me it seems a little backwards, but this is the way it is that the mortgagor is the person who actually grants a security interest in the land, right? This is typically the house buyer. So if I'm buying a house, I am the mortgagor. I'm going to mortgage that house to a mortgagee that's going to give me money in exchange for the security interest. And the mortgagee typically is a bank. We saw in Harnes versus Sprague, it was actually Harnes who decided to use his half interest in the joint tenancy as the mortgagor, and the security interest he granted was to the Simmons, and the Simmons then gave him cash that he gave to his partner, Sprague, to actually buy the house in question. So the mortgagor, typically the house buyer that's taking out the mortgage, the mortgagee, the one who's taking the security interest in the underlying real property in exchange for giving them cash, that's the typical relationship. And when you have this type of a relationship, a mortgagor and a mortgagee, you end up hopefully having some equity. And the equity is typically on the side of the mortgagor. And the equity is the difference between what is the current value of the real property, the land, and the security interest granted. At the most basic, the thought would be, I would like $80,000 from the bank, and I'm willing to put up my $100,000 piece of land as collateral. I, as the mortgagor, am going to have $20,000 of equity. This is the typical kind of 80%, 20% split that we usually want the mortgage to start with 20% equity toward the mortgagor, and then as time goes on and hopefully the property value rises and I start paying down the principal, what's owed on the mortgage, my equity rises as well. This is also sometimes called the equity of redemption, and the reason it's called the equity of redemption is that even if I, as the mortgagor, the home buyer, fail to meet the promissory note requirements, I still have some equity in the property that needs to be redeemed. And this equity of redemption, as we're going to find out, is what foreclosure is all about. It's about foreclosing this equity of redemption. So go to slide two. I'm calling this the kind of model mortgage, the standard mortgage, where the buyer, the mortgagor, contributes 20% equity up front. $100,000 house, I put $20,000 down as the mortgagor. I then go get a mortgage from a bank, the mortgagee, of $80,000. So I have 20% equity to start with. And the model mortgage also has some type of a fixed interest rate over a fairly long period of time. Usually, if you've ever heard this terminology, 30-year fixed, the idea is that I'll pay 4% or 5% or now maybe 2% on the outstanding money that I get from the bank in exchange for the security interest. And I have to pay it over a certain period of time. As I'm paying, at the beginning, the payments are mainly going toward interest, but near the end, they're really going toward the principal or actually the money that I've taken out from the bank, and my equity is rising. That's the hope. And the one thing that makes this unique, because we're creating a property interest, it's not just a personal interest between the mortgagor and the mortgagee, is that the mortgage runs with the land. That is, if I am the mortgagor and I take out the mortgage, I can't just have the mortgage disappear if I sell the property to somebody else. This would really make it tough to get mortgages because the fear would be the mortgagor would immediately turn around and sell to someone else, and now the bank, the mortgagee, is kind of out of any security interest at all. And so the mortgage runs with the land, and this is why we consider it to be a property interest, that this is something that runs with the land. And the one thing we learned in Harnes versus Sprague is that we can look at this as a title theory, right, where actually the mortgagee or the bank is actually the person who currently owns the property, right, and the mortgagor or the homeowner is the one who has a future interest. Or it's a lien, it stays in the mortgagor's hands. Either way, we've got an interest that's running with the land, and that's the mortgage. Now, let's say I sell the property to someone else. There's some legal terminology here that's of importance, and that is if I, as the mortgagor, sell the property that I've bought to somebody else and the mortgage is still there, the person buying it could take it subject to the mortgage. And what does this mean, subject to the mortgage? If I transfer subject to the mortgage, it means that the original mortgagor still owe the debt. That means me as the seller still owe the debt to the mortgagee. And the transferee, the person who bought it, is at no risk if they don't pay. Now, they're not personally at any risk. The property could still be foreclosed upon, but the purchaser is not taking any kind of personal liability if it's subject to the mortgage. In contrast, if I sell it to someone else and they assume the mortgage, now that means that the new owner, the buyer, agrees to pay the mortgage directly. Now, one thing we're going to find out with mortgages is we still have the promissory note, which is typically a personal liability. And so even on the assuming the mortgage, the bank could still try to go after the original purchaser personally if there's non-payment. But if we have an assumption of the mortgage, that means that original purchaser could turn around and sue the buyer, this new person, because they say, look, you assumed the mortgage. You were the one that promised that you would actually take hold of the mortgage. And so a lot of times banks, the mortgagees, really don't want somebody random, somebody that they've not been able to vet, to assume all the obligations of their mortgage. So a lot of time, original mortgages will have these no assumption clauses. And in fact, a lot of mortgages will have due on sale clauses. That is, if you're going to sell the property, the full mortgage needs to be paid up. This allows the bank to kind of reset interest rates at the time. It lets them kind of reevaluate who currently owns the property, because even if it turns out they're not the ones liable, the original person was liable, that person doesn't own the house anymore. I'm not really sure if I'm super comfortable with who has the house, et cetera. And this is why I might have a due on sale clause, which means that when the property is sold, the proceeds have to initially be used to extinguish the original mortgage, and then maybe a new mortgage is taken out going forward. So if you go to the third slide, we get the hypothetical here that's from the book. Suppose Joan Watson wants to sell her house to Sherlock Holmes. She still owes $40,000 in the house. This would be assumption she's the mortgagor. The mortgagee is a bank. She owes $40,000 on the mortgage. Holmes is actually willing to buy the house for $500,000. But Joan doesn't have $400,000 in the bank to pay off her mortgage, which has a due on sale clause. How can she accomplish the sale? Well, typically what happens here is that the bank will say, fine, sell the property, but when you sell it for $500,000, the due on sale clause triggers, and now $400,000 of that is going to go to the bank to extinguish the mortgage that Joan had taken out initially, right? And so the questions afterwards, right, so can she accomplish this on the sale? She certainly can. One question becomes is, though, before the sale, what's Joan Watson's equity? Well, the fact that Holmes is willing to buy it for $500,000 suggests that the fair market value of the house now is $500,000. And equity is the difference between what the mortgagor owes on the mortgage, here $400,000, and what the current value of the house is. And here it suggests that the current value is $500,000. So right now, Joan has $100,000 equity. What happens to the mortgage upon the sale? It gets extinguished. The proceeds from the sale immediately are used to extinguish the mortgage. And lucky for Joan, the market looks good. She's selling it for above what the mortgage is owed. And that means she can extinguish the mortgage. There can be instances, I'm not saying that I haven't been in these a couple of times, given that I've always sold houses at the wrong time of the market, where you're upside down. That is, the sale actually takes place where you have negative equity in the property. The property is worth less than the mortgage. And that means that for me to sell the house, I have to personally come up with that extra money, I being the seller, to extinguish the mortgage. Likely a new mortgage that comes up? Yeah, probably so, right? So Holmes, when he buys the house, if he doesn't have $500,000 cash, will become a mortgagor to a mortgagee, a bank. How much money out of pocket will Holmes likely pay at the purchase? Let's assume that we have an 80-20 type of scenario where the bank wants him to put up 20% so that they know initially out of the gate there's 20% equity in the house, right? So this would mean that they would need to come up with 20% of $500,000. And this creates 20% equity in the house that Holmes automatically has, right? Because he's got a mortgage that's only for 80% of the $500,000. So let's go to the fourth slide, and now we get introduced to this concept of foreclosure. So what we're doing here is we're just getting a lot of the terminology, new terms. We've seen this a lot in property law. We did this with systems of estates. We did this with landlord-tenant, etc. We're learning kind of new terminology, new legal fictions, etc. Well, what happens if the mortgagor can't meet her obligations under the promissory note? She can't make payments on time. She's lost her job or just doesn't want to pay. How does the mortgage itself get extinguished? And how does the mortgagee get a hold of the security interest, which is the real property that underlies this? Initially, back in the old days, essentially, there was what they called the law day or the must-pay day. And so under the promissory note, it said, look, if you don't pay within 5 days of your payment due or 30 days, we have essentially immediate foreclosure. And the only thing that happened then was that the property just got transferred to the mortgagee. And the mortgage got extinguished. It got foreclosed on. The real problem, at least the courts saw at the time, particularly the courts of equity, is, well wait a minute, what about the equity the mortgagor had built up in the property, right? If we go back to the previous example, if we foreclose on Joan, she has $100,000 of equity in the property. If we just allow foreclosure just because she misses a payment, the mortgagee gets a windfall, the equity gets extinguished, right, and Joan is out $100,000 that's there. So the court said, well, look, we need to actually protect this equity. There needs to be the ability for the Jones of the world to redeem this equity in some way. And so they created this equity of redemption. The problem was is that when they created the equity of redemption, it lasted forever. So this meant that Joan at any time could show up and say, no, actually, I'd like my equity out of the property. And this made it really difficult for mortgagees who are foreclosing and getting these properties to then resell them and get them back in the market. And so the courts of equity said, well, how are we going to extinguish this equity of redemption? And the way we're going to extinguish it is that we are going to foreclose on the equity of redemption. We need something that completely cuts off this property interest that's sitting on the property, this mortgage. And so there's a couple of mechanisms out there for foreclosure. These vary from jurisdiction. We're going to find out in Virginia, we do a deed of trust. There's a strict foreclosure mechanism that really isn't used by many jurisdictions at all. And we have some due process requirements to make sure that foreclosure makes sense under these particular scenario. You eventually get a court decree, and the title then just transfers to the mortgagee. The problem with this one is, what do we do about the equity? We're just distinguishing it and not allowing any kind of transfer one way or another. And this is why jurisdictions don't use strict foreclosure. We need a mechanism to get this equity, if there is any, back in the hands of the mortgagee. And so the way we do this is we have a judicial sale. And the big difference between a foreclosure sale and a deed of trust is not as much the due process requirements that are there, but who conducts it. In a foreclosure sale jurisdiction, this is a judicially ordered sale. I actually have to go through a judicial process to prompt foreclosure. In a deed of trust scenario, the mortgagee actually conducts the sale, not the courts. So it's a little bit faster. And all this is done to cut off the equity of redemption. And we'll talk a little bit as to some of the due process protections that are in place with regard to foreclosure, but we're not going to get deep enough in it for you to know the complete ins and outs of, let's say, deed of trust law in Virginia, but at least enough to understand the way courts maybe try to protect mortgagors in these particular scenarios. And so then go on to slide 5, right, and a little bit more about foreclosure. And so one big question we always ask about with foreclosure, and if you want an analog, we could think back to our partition by sale, is whether we really think foreclosure sales are likely to be market sales. And the reason we'd like them to be market sales is we'd really like to get the biggest equity. This would be the difference between the sale price and what's left on the mortgage. The hope is that if we go back to that earlier hypothetical, if we foreclosed on Joan, we'd have a market sale of $500,000. Joan would get her $100,000. The mortgagee would get the $400,000. They both get to go on their way. The problem with judicial sales, and we talked about this with the partition by sale, is that they're not market sales, right? These are not sales that were brought about just because of the movements of the market. These are pushed upon individuals because of judicial processes. And the concern here is that the sales will go below market value because of the conditions under which the sale is taking place. The other thing to think about is that if you're in foreclosure, that is, I'm someone, the mortgagor, who can't make my payments. What condition do you think the house is in, right? If I can't make my payments, it's unlikely I can upkeep the house in a condition to make it great for sale. And there might also be exterior conditions around me that are making it difficult for me to make my mortgage payments. The economy is going south, which means that even when I push this house on the market, they're not going to be people who are really ready to buy, and particularly ready to buy at true market value because things are going down. And so a lot of times when we have foreclosures, particularly mass foreclosures, fingers crossed, let's hope this doesn't happen, we're going to end up having foreclosure sales that are taking place when the foreclosure sale that takes place is not going to be enough to cover the mortgage, right? These are what we call kind of upside down sales. I don't know if anyone's ever, maybe more of you have purchased a car with a car loan, and they talk about the fact that right when you move the car off the lot, you're upside down the loan. You owe $20,000, but the car is only worth $15,000, right? So you actually have negative equity in the car, negative $5,000. And so we could have a lot of instances where we could have foreclosure sales that not only don't cover the equity, get the true equity back to the mortgagor, but don't even cover the mortgage. And this is why we really want due process safeguards in place, to try to see if we can get the most for the sale with the hope to at least extinguish the mortgage, but also get some equity in the hands of the mortgagor. And so we get introduced to these concepts of recourse loans versus non-recourse loans. Recourse loans are loans where not only does the mortgagee have the security interest in the property, but anything that's not met by the sale of the security interest, the person who took out the mortgage is personally liable for. I have recourse against the individual. And so that means that if I've got a $400,000 mortgage, the foreclosure sale only gets $300,000, I can go after the individual for that $100,000. Unlikely that they'll be good for it. They were in foreclosure. But you get this concept of a recourse loan. You can have non-recourse loans, and those are situations where I can't go after the individual. And the book talks about the fact that some jurisdictions basically force recourse loans to be converted into non-recourse loans. And when there's a foreclosure, you can't go after the individual. I think this is a scenario where you think about it. The fact that we've got foreclosure means the individual is already kind of down and out, and the ability to then go after them further for what's left over, if we have a below mortgage value sale, meaning things are just really bad in the economy, that we could end up having kind of a doubling, kind of negative effect if people are actually able to go after individuals for what's left on their mortgage after the foreclosure sale. And so there's a hypothetical after this. Betty Finn buys a house for $450,000. She puts down $90,000 and takes out a mortgage for $250,000 from Heather Chandler and a second mortgage for $110,000 from Veronica Sawyer. Right, so the $90,000, we've got our 20%. So you got our 20% equity, if I'm doing my math correctly, which I think I am. And then, right, we've got this leftover amount of $360,000, and she's got a one mortgage from Heather and a second mortgage from Veronica. Betty defaults. The house is sold for $500,000 at foreclosure, which is nice because that means it's being sold above what's out there on the mortgage. Assuming the mortgage due on the amounts due on the mortgages haven't changed at all, which really wouldn't be the case because the thought would be she at least made some payments on her mortgage. How do we distribute the proceeds? Well, the first thing we do is we get the equity back to Betty, and the equity would be basically the differential between the sale, $500,000, and what was due out on the mortgages, $360,000. So she gets $140,000, goes directly to her. And then we take the rest, the $360,000, and distribute them to Heather and Veronica. First mortgagee gets as much as she can get, and here actually extinguishes her full mortgage. So Heather gets it all to extinguish the $250,000. And then Veronica gets the rest, the $110,000, and we're all good and happy. What happens if things aren't going well in the market? Foreclosure sale happens. The house is bought for $350,000. So this is actually below what's due on the combined mortgages, $360,000. So the first thing that happens is Betty doesn't get anything. She actually has negative equity in the house, negative $10,000 equity in the house. And so what do we do with $350,000? Well, we extinguish the first mortgage because we've got $250,000 for Heather. The problem is we only have $100,000 for Veronica. This leaves Veronica out still $10,000. And if we've got a recourse loan, that means that Veronica can turn around to Betty and say, I need my $10,000. It's unlikely Betty has it, but she could do it. If it's a non-recourse loan, sorry, Betty, I don't have anything for you. And so that's how it kind of all works out and shows what our concerns we might have, right, if things turn upside down.